Civilian casualties at the hands of the United States and its partners are on the rise overseas.
There is deep and profound sensitivity that civilian life in these areas is valued less deeply and less profoundly than it is in the United States.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for October 7th, we'll look into the lack of accountability surrounding these civilian deaths. Also on the show, as impeachment moves ahead at home, President Trump continues to catch world leaders and analysts off guard with his unpredictable foreign policy announcements. Plus, smart devices from companies like Amazon are a hit with consumers, despite posing significant privacy risks.
Laws on the books governing privacy at the federal level did not envision, you know, an always-on corporate-owned microphone in your home or certainly on your ring finger in your car.
All right, let's start with the news out of the White House and the serious situation.
Do you think it's okay for President Trump to ask China to launch an investigation of Joe Biden and Hunter Biden?
I don't know if that's a real request or him just needling the press, knowing that you guys were going to get outraged by it.
Do you think it's appropriate for President Trump to ask China and Ukraine to investigate Joe Biden?
George, you really think he was serious about thinking that China's going to investigate the Biden family?
What did Peter Strzok mean when he texted Lisa Page on December 15, 2016.
Senator, what does this have to do with Ukraine?
It has everything to do with Ukraine. Now listen.
In Washington, D.C., House Democrats are continuing to move quickly with their impeachment inquiries. But even as the Ukraine scandal embroils the White House, President Trump has continued to press forward with an often unpredictable approach to foreign policy.
And we're following breaking news from Syria. In a major U.S. policy shift this morning, American troops are pulling back to make way for Turkey's planned invasion of part of northern Syria.
On Sunday, the White House announced that President Trump is putting his support behind a Turkish military operation in northern Syria, a move that represents a dramatic shift for United States policy in the region. Previously, the United States had partnered with Kurdish forces in Syria in the fight against the Islamic State. But this latest move clears the way for Turkey to take control away from the Kurds in northern Syria. Tweeting Monday morning in response to the news, President Trump said, quote, "We will fight where it is to our benefit and only fight to win." Meanwhile, officials from North Korea said that talks with the U.S. fell apart over the weekend in Stockholm, with the two countries unable to see eye to eye. And those latest developments come days after President Trump told reporters that Ukraine and China should investigate former Vice President Joe Biden's family for corruption. Some of the president's allies have claimed that those last comments were a joke. But statements like that have also been a staple of the president's erratic approach to foreign policy and can have very real consequences. Sarah Mendelson is a professor of public policy at Carnegie Mellon and a former U.S. representative to the Economic and Social Council at the United Nations. Welcome to The Takeaway, Ambassador Mendelson.
Glad to be here.
And Ishan Tharoor is a foreign affairs writer at The Washington Post. Ishan, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And we'll start with you. The Trump administration, Ishan, said they will allow Turkey's military campaign in northern Syria. Republican Senator and Trump ally Lindsey Graham said this could be, quote, a disaster in the making. How surprised were you by this news?
To be quite honest, I'm not that surprised. I mean, on one hand, of course, it's shocking that the Syrian Kurdish factions in this part of Syria and in northeast Syria have been the U.S.'s closest allies on the ground in the fight against the Islamic State. They've lost some 10,000 fighters of their own in this battle and have been really a steadfast U.S. partner in this particular context. But at the same time, we've always known that President Trump wants out of this situation, and that more broadly, and this is not just something to blame the Trump administration for, this has been a kind of problem for American policy in the region. The backing of these factions creates a huge dilemma vis-a-vis the U.S. relationship with Turkey, a historic partner, a NATO ally. And this kind of compromise or deal with the Turks was going to happen in some form or the other down the road.
A couple questions on that. I mean, the president's decision in northern Syria, I'm wondering if you could tell us how this fits into his broader foreign policy agenda, which so far seems to have been characterized by his impulsivity when it comes to a lot of these issues.
The situation in Syria, he's made it very clear in his Twitter storm that happened this morning, is one that Trump wants no part of. He believes that he has smashed the Islamic State, although that's not necessarily true. And now that that's done, he wants the regional players and he wants other countries to take care of the mess that's left behind. But yes, more broadly speaking, President Trump has approached foreign policy in various contexts through transactions. He has had a complicated set of dealings with the Turks over the past couple of years. Now, presumably, there is a kind of arms deal in the works as well, so that could be part of it. But more broadly speaking, I mean, every president is transactional in some way when he approaches foreign policy. But the transactionalism for Trump is about what's in it for Trump, not necessarily what's in it for the United States' interests. And in this case, Trump has promised very clearly that he wants out of Syria. He wants to not be engaged in certain conflicts anymore. And that is a political message he's made for his base and for his reelection campaign, and he wants to follow through on that.
Ambassador Mendelsohn, while this is going on, we can't forget that just last week's news, we'll pivot back to Ukraine here. At the end of September, you signed a letter along with more than 300 other national security professionals condemning President Trump's actions towards Ukraine in support of an impeachment inquiry. Tell us about that.
Well, let's recall the fact pattern. Number one, the president was applying political pressure to the new president of Ukraine, a foreign government, for domestic political purposes. That is to get essentially holding back on military aid, which was for Ukraine to defend itself against Russia, which has invaded its country since 2014, in order to get dirt on Vice President Biden and his family. So it's right to this point about his transactional attitude towards foreign policy for personal gain.
And Ambassador, you served under the Obama administration, but the group who signed that letter was bipartisan. Is that correct?
That's correct. And composed of professionals, people who'd served multiple different administrations. It wasn't a political gesture. It was a gesture about how we feel about this country and the duties of citizenship.
Ishan, last week regarding Ukraine, President Trump reiterated that Ukraine should investigate the Bidens. And he added on camera, we should note that he suggested China should do the same. Some of the president's allies have since said that the president was joking. But how have foreign leaders viewed or responded to statements like that by the president?
That's not a completely easy thing to gauge in just a few days. But what is quite clear to foreign leaders, and especially the diplomats I speak to here in Washington, is that this is a presidency where they know that if they want to get anything from the United States, they just have to appeal to the person at the top. They have to appeal to President Trump's own sense of self-interest. And time again, we've seen that in various ways play out. President Trump, as we said earlier, this is, of course, his very transactional worldview is tethered around his own political self-interest. But also what we're seeing, and especially as, you know, no number of fact checks about what the Bidens did or did not do in the Ukraine will dissuade Trump and his allies from peddling the same, frankly, conspiracy theories. And what we're seeing is this kind of creation of a conspiratorial worldview really take hold of a segment of politics here in this country.
Ambassador Mendelsohn, regarding Ukraine, the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch, was recalled from Kiev back in May. What precedent does the Trump administration's treatment of her set going forward?
It's a terrible precedent, but let me just step back and point to the gravity of the situation. Allies are looking at this situation and are deeply disturbed, not only by the decline of U.S. global leadership, but the erratic way in which U.S. foreign policy is being conducted. Dictators are looking at this and saying, aha, the U.S. is corrupt just like everybody else. We can get away with this. They're dealing in conspiracy rather than facts. This is directly out of the Putin playbook. And what's terrifying to a lot of us is that an ambassador like Masha Yovanovitch, total pro, absolute professional, for her to be yanked back from Kyiv to Washington, we knew that there was a political element to this. But if you think of diplomacy like flying an airplane, you need experienced pilots to land the plane. And there is a way in which this administration, certainly for the president, seems to favor not experts, not professionals, but his political proxies, people who are loyal to him, but who have no known experience with these countries or foreign policy.
Ambassador, additionally, Attorney General William Barr has been supporting the president by investigating conspiracy theories about the origins of the Russia investigation, and he's recently been meeting with leaders from Italy and Australia as a part of that effort. What does that investigation by the Attorney General, how does that affect the U.S. position on the world stage?
Well, I think the fact that the person he's appointed has no subpoena power is very confusing to a lot of us now. As a, not a lawyer, but observing this, it feels as if Mr. Barr is essentially, again, politicizing what has been a very long investigation by Robert Mueller, which is a detailed explanation of what I consider new Russian foreign policy, the policy of using technology and digital means to undermine, in this case, the 2016 U.S. election. We would rather see the Attorney General spending his time focused on what's going on inside the United States.
Ishan, the Trump administration has been engaging in a trade war with China. Talks with North Korea's government broke down over the weekend. Talks with the Taliban also recently fell apart. Does this impeachment inquiry into President Trump give him even less leverage in negotiating with these countries going forward?
I'm not sure if the impeachment inquiry itself is necessarily a problem for Trump vis-a-vis other countries. I don't think anybody who's actually watching this scenario thinks that a Senate with a Republican majority would remove Trump in this context. But what is the case is that we are, you know, 1 year away from an election, and a lot of countries are watching what's happening in the U.S. right now and hedging their bets. That means that a lot of deals are breaking down. A lot of proposals that we thought would have some meat on their bones don't really have any, such as the Trump-Kushner plan in the Middle East. And of course, at the same time, President Trump really does want to get some stuff across the line to show something to his voters in 2020. We know that, according to reporting from CNN, President Trump told the Chinese earlier this summer that he wouldn't make much of a fuss about the protests in Hong Kong or stand up for the Hong Kongers as long as these trade deals or trade negotiations are taking place. And that certainly does seem to be a kind of a sort of broader picture of how this administration has approached foreign policy throughout.
So, Ambassador Mendelson, you've also noticed that China is gaining more leverage within the United Nations as the Trump administration has been taking steps back. How significant is that?
It's significant on a number of levels. On the one hand, we're seeing a decline in U.S. global leadership in general. The Americans are just not there in the numbers that we've seen in previous administrations. So the Chinese are able to, they're giving more money to the UN, they're able to get important positions within the UN, but it really goes to this larger issue of the international order that we have been so involved in creating post-World War II. If we want to live in a world that is not rule of law bound, but rule of man bound, where there's an increase in corruption, where there's surveillance of citizens, as you see with the Uyghur population in China, then this is a particularly dangerous moment. For a lot of our allies, there's tremendous worry when you see this sort of cratering of U.S. engagement on so many issues, driven by this erratic president who is undisciplined and impulsive. And it's bizarre to me how much the president has played into the way in which the Kremlin thinks about Ukraine. The way the president talks about Ukraine as these terrible people and everybody's corrupt and isn't focused on the fact that Russia has invaded Ukraine and that there was a revolution in Ukraine in order to advance dignity and human rights and anti-corruption. And frankly, it's the same kind of dynamic on one level that's playing out in Hong Kong. So we've got a high-stakes game going on. We're either for human rights and the rule of law or we're not, and we're going to cede it and others are going to come into the vacuum.
Ishan Tharoor is a foreign affairs writer at The Washington Post. And Sarah Mendelson is a former U.S. representative to the Economic and Social Council at the United Nations from 2015 to 2017. Thanks to you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Last month, at least 40 civilians attending a wedding in Afghanistan were killed by U.S.-backed forces. A week earlier, a U.S. drone killed 32 pine nut farmers who were mistaken for terrorists. The incidents reveal a grim reality about the U.S. military's use of force abroad. In the first half of 2019 alone, the U.S. and its local allies were responsible for more civilian deaths in Afghanistan than the Taliban. That's according to the United Nations. In places where the United States continues its war on terror, drone strikes and conventional military assaults have resulted in a growing number of civilian casualties. Joining me now to talk about this rise in civilian casualties and what has changed over the past two presidential administrations is Finola Ni-Aloin, a Regents Professor at the University of Minnesota Law School and a UN Special Rapporteur on Counterterrorism and Human Rights. Finola, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me.
So what are the United States' responsibilities when it comes to protecting civilian life in a war zone?
So the U.S. has a number of legal responsibilities. These come from international legal standards, the most prominent of which are the Geneva Conventions, which tell us that states, any state, the United States included, has a particular obligation to ensure the protection of civilian life. That applies both to what we might call international conflicts between states, but also to conflicts that include non-state actors, whether that is the Taliban or other actors. Even in a counterterrorism context, which is the context that the U.S. legally describes itself to be in vis-a-vis the Taliban, there are still obligations to civilians. These are human rights obligations that the state holds.
Now, where exactly have we been seeing this increase in civilian deaths under the Trump administration?
Well, one of the things I think we should note is that the use of force in the context of Afghanistan is not new. It did not start with the Trump administration. Clearly, with the invasion of Afghanistan after the events of 9/11, there was an armed conflict. Civilian casualties have been a persistent and really problematic element of the U.S. engagement in Afghanistan. So I think the question to ask is, are we seeing an uptick or a difference in the way in which that is happening at the moment? And what are the legal consequences of that? Because the use of, for example, drones, which predate this administration, has been controversial throughout. It was controversial during the Obama administration, and it remains controversial today, precisely because these weapons have been seen to target individuals, civilians, women, children, defenseless people who have no reason to be targeted and who end up at the raw edge of military policy on the ground in Afghanistan.
I want to follow up on that because I agree. You're absolutely right. This is not a new strategy. I guess the question was twofold. Number one, have there been more civilian deaths under the Trump administration? And if so, why? I mean, what is it that is prompting that increase? Is it strategy? Is it error? Is it carelessness?
So one thing is to say that these numbers are disputed, but one of the big challenges we have with this particular administration is transparency. That is, because there's less information coming out about the how and the why and the who of who is being killed, we know less. So the numbers we have suggest a significant uptick, and those numbers even from last month and the reported media coverage. If it is the case that I think as we're seeing an uptick, we could ascribe two reasons to that. One is that there appears to be a loosening of the relevant legal rules that regulate in particular the use of drone strikes or death kills in this conflict zone. And the second is, and it's again, I want to qualify this by saying it's hard to measure given the lack of information we have, is that with the drawdown in troops, meaning there are less troops, U.S. troops on the ground, that there may be a heavier reliance on technologies that are less discriminate than troops on the ground might be.
We are also following Sunday night's news that President Trump will allow Turkish President Erdogan to seize control of the U.S.-supported Kurdish territory along the Syrian border. Do you have concerns about how this might affect civilians in the region?
Absolutely. I don't think there's a human rights analyst in the world who hasn't woken up and wondered what the consequences of this move will be. As we know, there is an enormous instability along that border. We have a Turkish government who has pressed for its openness and who has consistently said that the Kurdish presence in the border is deeply problematic to them as a political matter. But that Kurdish presence has in many senses stemmed the flow of ISIS and, in fact, contained the very terrorism threat that the U.S. has indicated it is so concerned about. So before we even get to civilians' deaths, which is an important and really key part of this, there are deep and profound security concerns about destabilizing that border at this time. We might have little reason to be optimistic that there would be protection for civilians on that border.
Let's talk a little bit about how the perception of the United States has changed in regions where civilian casualties have risen. I'm thinking, you know, just off of your comments now about the latest news at the Syrian border, but even beyond that.
So I would stress that I don't think the perception of the U.S. in relation to this particular issue, the use of drones or the targeting of civilians, has changed enormously. There is deep and profound sensitivity in many of these countries, particularly where drone technology has been used through the Obama and the Bush administration. Deep concern that civilian life in these areas is valued less deeply and less profoundly than it is in the United States. A sense of a lack of responsibility and the alienation that comes with the sense of non-accountability for civilian deaths in these areas. And bear in mind that these are exactly the same areas where the U.S. and its allies is consistently saying it needs to build civilian support to prevent a resurgence of terrorist groups. So the two goals are profoundly incompatible. You cannot bomb civilians one day and then expect them to be your allies the next day in the fight against extremism. It simply doesn't work that way. What you end up doing instead, rather, is creating a sense of the precariousness of human life and the lack of reliability for the major democracies in the region, the sense that the democracies who say they care about human rights on the ground really don't. It has been a barrier to embedding peace in a number of areas, including in Afghanistan. And more than that, it is the soup in which the sea of extremism will swim.
Fionnuala Nee Aloin is UN Special Rapporteur on Counterterrorism and Human Rights. Fionnuala, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and you're listening to The Takeaway. Thanks for being with us. So Amazon recently announced a slew of new smart hardware products, and those are everything from glasses to rings to earbuds to smart ovens. These are products with smart speakers that have become very popular with consumers. But they also have been criticized for how they erode privacy and basically hand over personal information to Amazon. And we asked you, and many of you told us, you're torn.
This is Reem calling from Ridgewood, New Jersey. Our family uses Alexa to play music, our favorite public radio stations, set timers. We do purchase things on Amazon through Alexa, and privacy is always a concern.
Hi, this is John Inga in Anacortes, Washington. We do use Alexa. However, knowing the privacy issues, we definitely unplug it every time we're not using it.
Hi, this is Kelly in San Jose. I use it to wake up in the morning. It controls the lights in my house. It monitors packages. I guess I assume that I have no privacy, and I've accepted that as the consequence for me to receive the conveniences.
And there's a lot of confusion about exactly what happens to your data when you have Alexa in your home. I mean, how much information it's collecting and where that information is going. So with all these privacy concerns, we were wondering why these products are just so popular with the general public. And if talking to a smart speaker will soon become just as normal as scrolling through your smartphone. Joining me now to clear up some of this confusion is Matt Day, a technology reporter with Bloomberg, and Sydney Fusell, a staff writer at The Atlantic who covers technology. Welcome to you both.
No, thank you for having me.
Matt, let's start with you. Specific to Amazon and the products that it's releasing, what can you tell us about the latest?
So Amazon is probably best known as far as its modern tech for its Alexa voice assistant, right? The resident of the Echo smart speaker that sits on your kitchen table, sits in your living room. And sort of the story of Amazon in the last few years has been their effort to make Alexa, the voice software, more pervasive, right? To put it on the road in the car with you, to get it on your smartphone, and recently, as of last week, to put it on your person, right? So that you can kind of summon this voice assistant, and get it to play music, ask it the weather, and do sort of other useful functions kind of in any context you might want to summon that piece of software.
Sydney, Amazon wants essentially to be everywhere and is everywhere right now. I mean, you know, you think about just your, you know, everything you buy. One of the reasons why I'm often hesitant to buy too much on Amazon, and probably an outlier here, is that I just keep thinking about how much they'll know about me. I mean,
I'm the same way.
Right? I mean, good. I'm glad. And is this about Amazon trying to get people in the habit to always be talking to its Alexa?
Yes and no. I mean, the latest sort of line of products that they were introducing was Alexa Wearables, which is literally a wearable microphone that you have, you know, on your hand via the Amazon Loop, I think it was called. It's a ring you have on your hand where you can talk to Alexa. Earbuds that you can talk to Alexa with. So on the one hand, yes, absolutely, they're trying to get you to go everywhere with Alexa. But when they were announcing the new products, what I thought was really interesting was they were talking about how you can, they used the phrase snack on information. They used the phrase focus on every day. And they were really focusing on not including screens with the new products. So on the one hand, yes, they're doubling down and they want you to take Alexa everywhere. But on the other hand, they're marketing these products as ways to get away from the phone, to get away from the notifications, as ways to sort of like relax or almost disengage from this intense screen-heavy, notification-heavy life we live. Dave Limp, who's the SVP of Alexa devices, said it's a way to focus on your everyday instead of looking at your phone all the time. So I think that they register that people like us are terrified and exhausted from Amazon being everywhere and, you know, checking out notifications all the time, but also like want a break from that, which is what they're saying these new products will do.
Matt, do we know how many people actually have Alexa?
So Amazon doesn't break out the figures, but we know that they sell millions of these things a year. Various surveys show that, you know, somewhere between a quarter or a third of American households have a smart speaker. They are definitely the market leader in this category they've invented, but there's plenty of company now. Google's marketing a similar device. Apple's got one on the market. There are a bunch of Chinese vendors working on this. So a lot of companies are betting that they're sort of in the future we want to, or we will be rather interacting with voice software rather than a smartphone or a computer screen.
Sydney, when I don't have an Alexa, but if I had an Alexa, if I gave it a command to do something, or if there have been lots of stories that say, you know, your Alexa is listening to your conversation and you don't even know it, where does that information go? Like, does Amazon actually do anything with that? Are they listening to my conversation?
Yes and no. There was a little bit of a scandal, and I'll tell you why that's not the best word for it in a minute. But basically, some information came out through, actually, I think Bloomberg broke this story about how when Alexa devices overhear you, one of the things that can happen with that data is they can sort of like excerpt little audio clips 30 seconds at a time and send that to human reviewers that are being contracted out who listen to the audio of what was excerpted out. And so basically, when you think of someone looking at someone, you know, sitting at a desk looking at three different things. They're looking at the audio that was excerpted, which is basically what you said to the device, and they're looking at what Alexa thinks you said. And they're comparing the two, and they're trying to see, okay, like, is Alexa good at, you know, listening to certain words, hearing certain accents, recognizing certain phrases? And so it was very startling for people to know that actual human beings would sometimes listen to the things that were recorded on Alexa, but, you know, 1% of 1% and only certain phrases, it's anonymized, et cetera, et cetera. But I think it's important to know that, you know, the old, like, oh, Alexa's listening. Yes, it is. And people are listening to me. Yes, they are. But the reason I don't really think of that as a scandal is that this is also true of devices connected to Microsoft Skype, connected to Facebook Messenger. This sort of idea of humans listening in and reviewing AI products to improve them already existed. That's just how they work. So the reason it's not really a scandal, to my mind, is that it's not like some like shocking thing. It's just how they work. I think it really illuminated how little we actually know about how these devices work or what it means when Amazon or Microsoft says, you know, we'll use your data to improve the device. We're just blind to a lot of these things.
One of the other places that we're seeing a lot of technology, Matt, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, because I was recently in a Tesla. I had not been in one before, was looking for any type of button that I could find. And guess what? There are no buttons. It's just a big old screen. A lot of technology is being implemented in cars now. And Matt, what is changing? I mean, how is technology in cars in terms of its software changing?
So there's kind of a couple of things that works. The first is just the immense amount of processing power compared to the old days that you can pack into a small device. So cars essentially are becoming sort of powered by computers, right? Whether it's regulating the engine or sort of showing you that, you know, infotainment device to listen to music or what have you. And so that combined with, you know, sort of big tech's interest in the car, whether it's Tesla, whether it's Google or Apple or now Amazon trying to put its applications on your car, people just kind of see the car as sort of an extension of this modern computing age, right? And that's kind of the change we're seeing as our apps are going to start to follow us into our cars. And then as we've been talking about voice, one of the big pushes recently is getting kind of voice software on the dashboard, right? Your ability to, you know, toggle a station or the climate control system without lifting a finger. So maybe it's not just the buttons that'll go away. Eventually, you'll just do it all with your voice is kind of the aim of big tech right now.
Sydney, you talked about how Amazon has given a very small amount of its Alexa audio recordings to people to transcribe. And when that became public, it really upset a lot of people. I mean, even though it's standard practice for a lot of tech companies that make these smart speakers. So what's Amazon's stance on privacy these days?
Sort of broadly speaking, when we look across industries, across technologies, we're trying to make everything smaller and faster and cheaper and eventually render it invisible, going, you know, from like touch tones to a touch screen, going from a touch screen to just no screen whatsoever. It's just operated by your voice. So I think that on the one hand, we're sort of seeing privacy emphasize certainly all these, you know, everyone has a privacy policy. Everyone puts out statements about how they respect privacy. Alexa, for example, has this option to go in and pause recording or delete past recordings. But I think that on the one hand, you have an emphasis on privacy, but technology itself is moving the opposite way, where they don't even want you to really think of these as devices. One thing I think about when I think about Alexa is that it doesn't feel like you're Googling something. You know, you're not holding anything in your hand. So I think that we're sort of seeing a sort of like Amazon's going two different directions at once, where on the one hand, they emphasize privacy and like, yes, we care about it. You should care about it too. But on the other hand, they're doing these things to make it where they collect your data without you even realizing you've used a device because everything's getting smaller. Like it went from a speaker to just like a ring on your finger, but it's the same interactions and the same data is being collected. So I think that in terms of where Amazon is, they're going to continue to say that they care a lot about privacy, but they're going to make their products so seamless and so invisible and so easy to use that you don't even think about how your data is being collected.
Matt, what are your thoughts on that? I mean, one thing that years ago, the federal government was very much involved in this privacy fight, particularly when it came to data brokers, people that take the information and decide what they want to do with it and sell it later. One of the responses to that has been giving consumers the ability to, quote, opt out, to say, I don't want, you know, cookies or I don't want any of this other information, and whether that's on Facebook or other places. But I find that the ability to do that, I don't know how important that is to folks. What are you seeing?
Well, it's a great question how much people actually care about privacy. You know, when it comes to voice assistants, you know, somewhere about a quarter of people say they would never buy a smart speaker just because they're worried about the privacy implications. But I think from a broader perspective, you know, certainly in the U.S., the technology has outpaced, you know, government regulation on this. You know, so many of the laws on the books governing privacy at the federal level did not envision, you know, an always-on corporate-owned microphone in your home or certainly on your ring finger in your car. And so I think there's kind of a view in big tech that, you know, as long as you have consumers' consent, you know, via these really broadly written privacy policies that, of course, none of us ever read, there is a lot you can do with that data. And, you know, oftentimes, you know, as we've discussed with Alexa, it's things that they were not necessarily upfront about or taking you with them on. There's just a lot that we don't know and a lot that consumers don't bother to read up on, you know, when they start using these devices.
And Sydney, we've talked a little bit about how this information is being used, and we're seeing a lot about what these products can actually do. But do these smart devices, in your opinion, outweigh the privacy costs? I mean, you know, why aren't people more concerned? Is it just because we're used to it, and younger generations in particular, this is what they've been raised on, and they're used to kind of, you know, being more public about their lives?
I think that's part of it, but I also like to sort of zoom out a little bit and go back to the Jetsons, which I was a big fan of when I was younger.
Thank you, Sydney. I like the Jetsons too. Thank you.
Yes. And I mean, ultimately, we were excited about this. I mean, decades ago, before we even knew what an IoT device was, we were excited about the idea of just a home that sort of operated itself and helped you out. And so I think that just at a baseline level, we want these products because they're cool and they're helpful. But I mean, I also think that sort of to argue against myself a little bit, one part of this conversation that doesn't get brought up a lot is accessibility. And so smart home devices and voice assistants are extremely useful for people that are older, people that are disabled. They do lots of really helpful things in terms of, you know, being able to alter the thermostat or, you know, turn on the oven with your voice, or, you know, instead of like trying to find the remote and pick it up, you can, you know, use your voice. As Amazon goes from device to device and each one becomes more normal, we've already given a little bit of data. And so, you know, what's a little bit more? If I already have Alexa collecting what I say at home, it's not that big of a deal to, you know, put it on my ring finger and then, or like put it in my car. I think that it starts off just like a little bit at a time, and then over time we become used to it. As time passes and they move from device to device, it gets easier and easier to sacrifice privacy because you've already sacrificed a little bit, and these devices are genuinely useful.
The flip side to that is for Amazon in particular, that they've come under scrutiny in the way that they cooperate with the federal government and with local law enforcement in terms of the use of their technology. I mean, are those relationships based on data that Amazon collects from everyday users?
They are, yeah, and that's one of the kind of risks as we turn over all of this data. And that companies learn so much more about us from our behavior online, from our behavior talking to voice assistants, is companies often don't go about deleting that data. So what happens when that data is sitting in a pile somewhere is that governments can come calling for it, right? In the U.S., often, and ideally, that's with a warrant. But Amazon's sort of smart doorbell and camera division Ring out of Southern California has come under some scrutiny for ongoing relationships with police departments. In some cases, they've offered an app where, with the user's consent, you can turn over video recordings of your front porch, say, proactively to police departments. And then, of course, there's the flip side of what happens when the authorities come knocking for what they know is there anyway. And it's kind of a gray area in law, particularly around voice assistants, exactly what access governments have to it and how informed users should be about that process.
I just want to follow up on what Matt was saying, which is something people don't realize, which is that Fitbit data, which is on your wrist, and then Amazon Ring data, as well as Alexa data, they've all been used in murder trials. They've all been used as ways to create a timeline by police to see, what was this person doing before and after a certain event. And I think that that's scary for people, but it's a turning point. And I think that it's interesting because on the one hand, the law itself is very much behind the times. But on the other hand, police departments are very much with the times. And so they're interested in social media. They're interested in Amazon Ring footage. They're interested in Nextdoor and Citizen. Police departments are turning right at the same pace as Amazon. I think we're a little bit behind. And I think that the law itself, in terms of regulations around data collection, particularly in the U.S., is the furthest back. They're the slowest.
My question to you then, I guess that the last question would be, is it possible for anyone to be, quote unquote, off the grid?
No, that's a great question. I mean, not if you opt into any of these online services, certainly. I think it's just getting harder and harder to accept the conveniences of that, or to avoid accepting the conveniences of that, rather, offered by all these modern technologies. In a lot of cases, it's the only way to fully opt out and get off the grid, as you say, is to not use them at all. Sort of the default trade-off you make when you plug in that smart oven is that smart oven is tracking every time you turn it on or off, and you might not be completely informed as to where that data goes. So these are just by using this tech and by being on the grid, you are certainly developing a profile of yourself with these tech companies. No other way around that besides unplugging the thing in many cases.
Matt Day, technology reporter at Bloomberg, and Sydney Fusell, staff writer at The Atlantic. Thanks so much for joining me.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.